air conditioners made by Daikin, Mitsubishi Electric, and Fujitsu, Japanese, and those are like a two-part mini split. I'm just curious if anybody has experience in this matter. N2XGN, but to the story.
Okay, I have nothing particular to say one way or the other. It's very reminiscent of what old K2RIW spent a technical net one night on the flanges of his refrigerator.
Is anybody who is working with air conditioners right now listening to us? Oh, it doesn't look like. So, air conditioner, when you mount it in the window, maybe I start from the beginning. We have a double-hung window. To safely secure the window air conditioner, you must screw the top mounting rail or the flange of the unit directly into the window sash to prevent it from being pushed out or falling. That creates a permanent hole in the window visible every time you change the unit. So, when I was looking at Midea, which is like a U-shaped unit, that it hangs, no, it doesn't hang, it's a U-shaped unit, but up. So you put it into the window, and then you can close the window, open the window anytime you want to. But that one has so many problems as well. And then we have a General Electric, which is reverse U-shape, so that would be lowercase N-shape. You can actually put the U on the lower part of that window and close the window, and then will never fall down. So I found that those being extremely quiet, at least. But the problem with this is, let me drop.
No, this is for the answer.
Whip it again.
What size? How many tissues is it that?
If you ask me about the size, it's typical window, double-hung window.
So, how many tissues is the air conditioner who went past it?
Dr. Roy, I didn't understand.
Tissues.
Did you take fuse, Ed?
This thermal unit.
BTUs.
Yeah, BTUs. How many BTUs?
BTUs, 10,000 BTUs.
That's marginal for passing a window. Instead of there, they have to punch a hole in the wall. Window is usually from 5,000 to 10,000 BTUs max. Because then they become too
Roy?
Yeah, I think Ed is trying to tell you that at that size, usually they punch through the wall and mount it through the wall rather than hanging it on the window.
Yeah, so traditionally, we had a big unit in the window. But then they made those two units, one which is looks like a U and allows any time you want open the window, and the other one is like an inverted U that actually is on the lower part of that window permanently. So you can close and open up the window, but this thing will never fall down. So it's like two units. You have a compressor, so evaporator coil hangs below the horizontal framework, forcing condensation to drain up and over a bridge rather than having a straight downward path. So we have that's the difference between MIDEA or MIDEA and the General Electric N-shape unit. So, but there is something that exactly what the gentleman was talking about. It's a two-part unit made by Mitsubishi or Daikin or Fujitsu, and this one is only 19 dBs. So we're talking about 31 dBs is what is the level of quietness in the library. You have 19 dBs, you cannot hear it. And that one is made from the inner inside unit and outside unit through the wall, yes. And to X-ray, and back to you, Dr. Ray.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was thinking, is there somebody who's listening to us who has experience with any one of two types of those air conditioners, whether the U-shape, whether the inverted U-shape, or the one that has a two parts, one outside and one inside. So the outside one is mounted on the wall, and the inside is actually the one that could be put in any place inside of the room. Back to you.
Okay, well, if anyone is familiar with that and would like to say a few words, please hit the push to talk, I guess.
N1YDY, Wes, what is your basic question about the split unit? Are you just trying to compare whether a split unit is as efficient as an all-in-one mount, or what's the basic question?
Yeah, the basic question is, if I have to spend money for the new unit, I rather spend more for the unit that for the longer time will be trouble-free or problem-free and will be quiet. And we're talking about 10,000 BTU, but two.
Well, the quiet part is the easy part to answer, because you're separating the compressor from the evaporator. It's certainly going to be quieter in the house to have the split unit. So in other words, the thing where there's something outside and then there's a thing on the wall on the inside. In terms of longevity of these units, that all depends on the manufacturer. They're all basically built with the same quality components. The question is, what type of warranty and customer service can you get from the people that were involved with building it? I come at this, you know, as an aircraft mechanic, and I think of it in terms of the different components and all the rest of that. You know, it really just all depends on who puts the package together and how well they're willing to service it.
Also, I just thought about the inside and outside the split. We have a compressor outside, and like you said, an inside unit goes through the window. There's a couple of pipes and wires. Those are really the way to go, but the problem is they're really only used for a first-story window, which is usually going to mount the compressor on the ground.
Well, Ed, they can also mount the compressor on the roof, depending upon the design. The compressors can be mounted in any number of places. It doesn't have to be just one story. But again, it's the issue of, you know, who built the unit and how well they're going to do it. Certainly, if you're going to have to deal with a possibility of failure, it's easier to replace an entire window unit, if you will, one of these all-together units. You just slide the old one out and put the new one in. And, you know, it's ugly, but it is certainly the easiest to repair in terms of, I shouldn't say repair, to replace at the end of its service life. N1YDY.
I do thank you very much for that advice. I'll try to avoid this part of the conversation when talking about Chinese quality issues. It's above of the mentioned by me air conditioners GE and Madia Chinese right now, because Chinese bought GE home appliances from GE, and they are good for 4 years to use their name. So talking in English, experts suggest that striving for the excellent rather than perfection is the key to improvement. When applied kindness in words already looks like a condom forced to fit the sentence, balancing on the edge of profanity. So I'll be kindly asking for help in how to describe Chinese labor quality the way it really truly is presented to us in almost every product that comes from there, and avoid use of strong, harsh, inappropriate language. I assume that you both rather suggesting me to spend 3-4 times, which I have no problem to spend, but buy something that is Japanese or American made. Is it true? And to exist.
Another question. How is the area you want to prove?
Yeah, those units are mostly for the tenants of mine. I'm trying to make their life easier. So if I have a tenant for a number of years, I rather invest in the good air conditioning system that has less of a problem than they had before. And it's more quiet and too
exhausting. Brenner, how big is the room that's supposed to air condition, or the space that's supposed to air condition?
I'm sorry, it's probably too loud in here around me. Dr. Roy, could you help me out with understanding that?
Yes, Ed is asking you for the dimensions of the room you're trying to cool.
250 to 450 square feet.
By 650.
That is approximately right. So, no matter what is the shape, usually it is for walls 250. So 250, I assume 10 BTU would be probably somehow okay. Am I right? And to exit.
I understand that 10,000 BTU may be more than you need there. A typical bedroom, say 12 by 12 or 10 by 12, only is 5,000 BTU.
I don't have a problem with 12,000 BTU if it's needed. Just I want the satisfaction of the people living in my houses.
I think the rule is other people are never satisfied with what you do.
All right, let me just jump in here for 1 second, M1YDY. If you're on the cusp between 12,000 and 10,000, there is one thing to think about, and I don't know where your unit is, but you want to have, there's a thing called ring out, and you want to have a unit that runs long enough to act as a dehumidifier as well as a cooling agent. So if you have more BTU cooling capacity than the space requires, a lot of times it'll cycle off when it reaches temperature, but it will still be way too humid or muggy inside the room. So if you're right on the cusp between one of two different sizes, you might be better off to be on the, take the lower side.
Confirmed. Absolutely. Confirmed that.
I do. Thank you very much for that. I didn't even think about it. It's very important information. So, do you both suggest that I should rather equip at the lower side of the size of the room, let's say, if the room is properly cooled with 450 BTU, I'm sorry, with 450 square feet, I would rather go with 10,000 BTU, which would be the lower edge, the lower, you know what I'm talking about, back to you.
Capacity is the word you're looking for. And that's certainly one possibility. The other thing to think about is the heat loading of the room. Is the room exposed to a lot of sunlight? Is the room shaded by trees? Things of that nature. So that's all part of the calculation that an HVAC professional will use to recommend what size compressor you need. And with that, gentlemen, I got to go. N1YDY, I'm clear.
Also, it's an assistant. Now, this says about some 250 square feet to 450 square feet. That's a huge home.
Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. For your advice. It's the time for Space Report. Dr. Roy, back to you.
Okey-doke. Thank you, Wes. Thank you, everyone who participated. I hope you had a fun time. I hope you'll join us next week when we try this all over again. But about 10:20, a perfect time to toss it over to WS2N, Paul, for the SpaceNet Report.
D2GS, WS2N. Okay, Roy, very good. And, a couple of things happening in the space world. This morning anyway, they had a launch of another New Glenn rocket. Now, if you follow the New Glenn story around me, I have. It's the third successful launch. It's a rocket by Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos. And I got these crackling noises on my radio. Anyway, I wonder if that's okay. How's my transmission for you? This rocket is, it's 2 or 3 feet high, almost as high as the same rocket that took people to the moon, and that was the SLS. This thing is the New Glenn. Of course, it's nowhere near as powerful as the SLS system that had 8.8 million pounds of thrust, and comes up to around 4 million pounds of thrust. It's got four engines attached to it, with liquid kerosene and liquid oxygen. The second stage has liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, so it's a mixed system. And they run the B3 engine off of that, two of them. So yeah, it got off the ground successfully. It had about a 40-minute delay, but they did take off. The goal is to put the satellite into orbit, a large satellite made by AST. AST is a company that's trying to build satellites to be able to work with cell phones. So I could, if I had my cell phone down here, I'd be able to transmit the antenna that they're working off is so big and you know, so sensitive that it would work with my cell phone. So yeah, they have six of them up there already, and this is going to be the seventh one. Their goal is, over the years, to have around 50 or 60 big satellites. And, you know, the antenna is, they said it's like 2,500 square feet, you know, so it's like roughly 50 by 50. So, you know, it's like a house, you know. So, yeah, you know, I watched it. It was, you know, I'm glad to see it go up. They have everybody from the company is cheering it on. And then the goal, of course, is to save the first stage and reuse it. Now, the first stage that was just launched was already back in November. So that stage was caught by a drone ship called Jacqueline, and they're reusing that first stage. Sure it is, all these months later, they refurbished it, you know, made sure everything's okay, and sure enough, it went up, and it came back down, landed on the ship again. Very successful. So these boosters could launch, well, they're saying 25 different times, you know, for reuse or more. Well, this one's up to two. So, yeah, that was the good news. The second stage ignited. I waited for that after the first stage was, you know, was landed. You know, the story continued. Second stage ignited its two BE-3 engines, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. Same engines that are used for Blue Origin's manned program when they launch people on a suborbital flight. And that engine is a little over 100,000 pounds of thrust. And two of them, and they used that for the second stage on the New Glenn rocket. So that ignited, and I saw that. And then about an hour later, they were supposed to reignite again, and that was going to push the antenna into its proper orbit. Sure enough, about an hour or so later, I read about on the internet that apparently that didn't happen. Well, if it happened, it didn't work properly. So it's unable to put the satellite into its proper orbit. It's falling way short of where it's supposed to be. And again, I probably read another hour later that AST did turn the satellite on, so it would have worked in the proper orbit. It's way too low, and in a short period of time, it will deorbit and burn up in the atmosphere. So it'll be try again. So now Jeff Bezos has to go back to the drawing board and find out what's wrong with their system that isn't going to work. The good news is that they caught the first stage again, and we'll be able to reuse it. I don't know if anybody saw this this morning or heard about it. Does anybody have any comments about it? This is WS2N.
Hi, Paul, KF2ZZ.
Yeah, okay, KF2ZZ. And first, I heard Frank, I believe. Go ahead.
Which one of us do you want to go ahead, Paul?
Oh, you. I'm sorry. Yeah. so it was just Brian and you. Is there another Frank that I'm missing?
No, maybe I wasn't paying close enough attention. I wasn't clear whether you wanted Brian or myself to go ahead. It's too bad the satellite didn't make the right orbit. But the thing I don't get, based on my experience about 25 years ago playing with FM satellites, is the limiting factor, I don't think, would be signal strength coming up from the ground and being able to receive the signal. The limiting factor would be that you're going to have hundreds or thousands of cell signals, and the satellite is going to have to pick out just the ones that want to be retransmitted from all this QRM. I realize I use a much more sophisticated form of modulation than what we use on a 2-meter FM or a 70-centimeter FM satellite uplink, but it still seems to be a difficult problem. You'd have to have either TDMA, a time division multiple access, time division multiplex, or frequency division multiplex, or FDM, that it worked nearly perfectly so that every cell phone got a clear shot at the satellite. Do you have any idea how there'd be no problem with the cell phone hearing the satellite, I wouldn't think, because there's only one satellite they're listening for, or a very limited number of them. Go ahead.
Okay, you know, I could look up the frequencies that they're using and all, which doesn't really tell me much. They do have like a gateway that they're transmitting down to. So, you know, let's say there's 100 transmissions at the same cell phone. They're apparently going down to some kind of a gateway, you know, and then from there, you know, going out to the rest of the world. But, yeah, they have frequencies like 1700 to 2200 megahertz. They have telemetry frequencies, which was problematic for us, for amateur radios. They wanted to use 430 to 440 megahertz band, you know, so that was a problem in the ARRL. They had some kind of a writing campaign people wrote in, and I think they got it changed, or some kind of stipulation, you know, where it wasn't going to be exactly right. And they gave out specific frequencies like 430.5, 432.3, and so on, a couple more here. So, that's pretty strange. And then their gateway frequencies, they're trying to use, they said 37.6 gigahertz. There was another one, 40 gigs and 60 gigs. They apparently got that, parts of that, those bands. So, you know, but the, that's all I know on that. You know, how they're going to handle, you know, thousands or if not millions calls at the same time, I'm not really sure. But the antenna is big. I mean, I saw pictures of it, you know, laid out on a, you know, in a lab somewhere with people standing next to it, and you know, it's really, I mean, it's like 50 feet by 50 feet, so, you're right.
There are a couple of possibilities, like that the antenna has so much gain that it can zero in on just one cell signal at a time. Using electronic steering, I suppose. I don't understand the ground-based gateway concept, though, because if you have a ground base, if the cell phone can reach a ground base gateway, either here or sent to a ground base gateway, then you probably don't need a satellite, because I thought the whole point of satellite-based cell service, or at least the whole point of satellite-based service using cell phones, because I'm not convinced it's really using a cellular concept anymore if it's in space. But anyway, the whole purpose of satellite accessing a cell phone is that you're not near ground-based cell towers or gateways. So I don't quite get that concept either. go ahead.
This is a couple of years ago. I mean, they've been launching these things now for about a year or two. The last launch was by India. You know, they launched on one of their big rockets. They have two rockets that they use for the type of thing. One is launching on polar types of orbits, and the other one, you know, like the geosynchronous orbits. But they launched, I think, up to six. So this would have been the seventh one. And it's not, you know, as far as I know, it's not operational, of course. You know, a lot more. So I would imagine if I transmit up from here and I'm going to talk to somebody in Japan, it has to come back down. You know, that one satellite can't talk to two cell phones at the same time. That satellite won't be able to be talking to Japan. It's on the other side of the globe. So I took it that they had to transmit down to the ground, and then, you know, through the ground, they one way or another, that signal would then get to get over to Japan, and I'd communicate that way. So, you know, and then if somebody else is using another of the sync satellite in Japan, yeah, they could talk back up to that satellite, but they'd have to come back down to talk to me. Back to another gateway. That's the way I read it. I'm not really sure, of course, how this works. I cared more about this rocket going up, but now it is this the satellite. By the way, it's called AST Bluebird, the Bluebird system. Back to you, Brian.
Now, I could certainly understand the nation of India having an investment in this system, because they certainly have parts of India that I'm sure have absolutely no access to cellular service for many hundreds of miles around. I mean, we think of India as being some of the major cities, I guess, as Madras or some of the other cities that we talk to call centers in all the time, but I don't think that's most of India. And, of course, the outlying islands also. Anyway, yeah, I think there's a lot of... But, yeah, I think I understand what you're talking about, the gateways. It's also for the downstream to populated areas bring the signal back to people who do have terrestrial service. That makes some sense. Anyway, it's that is interesting. Thanks a lot, Paul. BB2BX. So back to that.
Definitely. And I know I'm going to be reading a lot more about this once they. This company has other launch more of these big satellites, and let me turn it over to Brian and say hello to him. Thanks, Frank. Back to you, Brian. WS2N.
All right, good evening, Paul. Hope you're doing well, and everyone listening. I was reading about the Blue Origin satellite mishap, but It's unfortunate, you know, but I guess these things happen. And as long as it's not a, you know, a frequent event, they will press on. And I'd like to know, Paul, if you have any information on two things. One, did they ever look at the heat shield on the Artemis capsule and see how it held up? And two, when is SpaceX going to launch its Starship again for another test flight? Thanks.
Yeah, well, pushing the time frame back, they should have done it, it was early March. That got pushed back to April, and now I'm hearing sometime in May for the next Starship launch. And that's still not scheduled to go into orbit. That's still it's still going to be another suborbital flight. So they got a long way to go. This company, Blue Origin, this is their large version of the rocket. You know, they're competing directly with the Starship, with the New Glenn rocket. You know, New Glenn is big. It's SpaceX has been catching rockets for years now. In fact, they said that they've recently caught the 600th flight, you know, returning from space. So these things go up, you know, 20, 30, or more times each. And then, you know, they have boosters that they've built over the years. So they're up, where New Glenn is now up to three. Well, they've collected actually two. The first one did not make it back to the ship. So number two and three were successful. But the difference is, New Glenn is like the equivalent of like maybe four times the size, you know, volume wise, as a Falcon 9. Falcon 9 is what, 220 some odd feet high, and that's the size of the first stage of this thing. This thing is 310 feet, something like that. With a big, you know, 7 meter bearing. Bearing is the diameter of what this thing can hold. So it can hold huge, huge loads, which is good because they're getting ready. Not launch, but coming up sometime this year. When I say they, I mean Blue Origin, with the New Glenn, to launch a cargo vehicle to the moon. And the cargo vehicle, it's called the MK1, Blue Moon. There's an MK2, Blue Moon. That's the crewed version. This is the cargo version. The crewed version is probably twice as big as the cargo version. The cargo version is large. I mean, it's you know, easily twice the size of the LEM that landed on the moon for Apollo. And that should get off the ground sometime, I would say, definitely this year. And if successful, they need to show that they can land exactly where they say they're going to land on the moon before, of course, they ever land a crew to go on to the moon. So the two companies that have that contract for the human landing system is SpaceX and Blue Origin. So they're competing. Well, they're both going to be doing it. It's not like they're going to pick one and that's it. You know, all the moon flights are going to be just one company. You know, who's ever ready first, you know, will get first landing. Where, you know, a couple of months ago, last year, it was SpaceX was going to be first for the first moon landing, and then second for the second moon landing, and then it was going to be Blue Origin after that. Now it's, you know, whoever raised the first is successful. And when I say successful, that means actually landing on the moon with an uncrewed version of a crewed vehicle. So, going up later this year is a crewed version, is a cargo version, the crewed version, would also have to be successful. And that would all have to happen. They're trying to do all this before 2028. And I don't think both companies are going to make it by that time frame. But we'll see. You never know. Yeah, and as far as the shield, I talked about it. I think I talked about it quite a bit last week, but we'll do it again. Initially looked at it. It was actually coming down, you know, from space. They had drones and helicopters and, you know, taking pictures of the shield as it was, you know, coming down on parachutes, trying to get some early views of it. And then after it landed in the water in the Pacific, when the recovery team went out on their boats from the USS Mercer to pick them up, they had specialized divers that would go underneath the water with cameras and took, you know, pictures of what it looks like. They didn't want to take a chance. You know, they didn't want to wait. They wanted to see pictures right away in case something changed, you know, as it was sitting in the water. And they said all those pictures came back pretty. The view was, they did a news conference, and Reed, who was the commander, talked quite a bit about it. That they looked at it early on, right, you know, after the Artemis II was actually on the boat on Mercer, before the crew went back to Houston. They were still on the boat. They went down to where the spacecraft was. You know, they got the pictures taken in front of it, but they looked at it, you know, visually, they said it looked good. But he did make it that, you know, NASA is going to study this heat shield. He said they're not going to look at every molecule. They're going to look at every atom of that heat shield to see how it did. So, preliminary report, Brian, is supposed to be very good so far. Back to you.
Okay, well, I'm glad that everything went, you know, normally, and I'd like to see some pictures of the heat shields when they release them, and thank you, Paul. Appreciate everything that you do, and I'll be on the site.
Oh, yeah. A lot of these people are waiting for side-by-side pictures, I'm sure, between one and number two, and they're going to take a look to see, you know, if everything that they did with the reentry work. You know, the idea was this time was to come barreling in straight in without going back, you know, skipping back up out of the atmosphere, back into space, and then coming back down again. That's what Artemis One did. And the reason they do that is because they get a high, accurate landing. They can come very close to a recovery ship by doing something like that, by skipping back in, you know, back up and back down again. Space shuttle used to do that. Apollo spacecraft, when they came back, they used to do that. They always know that they have the chance of coming bowing straight through, which they've done for a number of different flights. Progress did that, and they said that was they had to do it when they were doing Soyuz. It was a Soyuz craft. It was a crew version of the Russians, but this thing was done, planned to come barreling in. This way, the heat shield would get very hot, you know, could handle up to 5,000 degrees, but Yeah, it would get hot, but it wouldn't cool off and then get hot again. They think the first time with Artemis 1 was when it came through the atmosphere, and then they skipped back up higher in space and back down again. And that temporarily cooled off. The heat migrated deeper into the heat shield, and when it cooled off, the gas would expand and would pop the heat shield in certain different spots. And then that's why they had such a problem. This way, by barreling in straight down, it has less time to have heat migrate into the depth of the heat shield. You know, this way they're coming in at, instead of 14 minutes the first way, they come in through eight minutes. So it's a lot less time, and apparently it worked out okay. The thing they're losing is the accuracy. They planned it, you know, the computer worked out everything exact, where they wound up landing very close to the recovery ship Mercer. So the next flight would be Artemis 3. That should really definitely not have a problem for two reasons. One, that they're definitely going to have an upgraded heat shield on Artemis 3. And the other reason is the speed that they're coming through will be 17,500 miles an hour, not 25,000 miles an hour. That's the speed you come through when you're coming back from the moon. So two reasons that shield will be probably no problem at all. The next time they'll have to worry about something like that is because that shield will be on future Artemis missions, such as 4 and 5 and 6 and so on. You know, and 4 and 5 will be the first ones that will actually go to the moon and have a crew land on the moon. So that'll be the first real test of the new heat shield as that comes barreling back from Artemis 4 and eventually Artemis 5. So I'm sure we'll be looking at that heat shield with fine detail when those two come back from the moon. Any comments for the next?
I have an interesting idea. Why don't you take the stage of the New Glenn rocket, that's the first stage, and then have it meet in low Earth orbit with the Artemis capsule, and then have it just come down together so it can land right on the ship. That would be kind of fun, right?
Yeah. Speeds never get up to speed. It does get to around 4,000 or 4,500 miles an hour, I think, tops, which is nowhere near 17,000 miles an hour that an orbital spacecraft or 25. Know, in space. In fact, the first stage, it's only suborbital. It's 100 kilometers, which is a little over 62 miles. And then it separates, and that pushes the vehicle from the 4,000 or 5,000 miles an hour all the way up to 17,500 or further if they're going to, you know, leave Earth orbit. But miles an hour. Meanwhile, the first stage never makes it that fast, and then that comes barreling through the atmosphere. Comes too hot, but nowhere near with the temperatures of a returning spacecraft. From orbit, never mind, from the moon. So that's, you know there's no way to be able to do that. There is plans eventually of companies, including Blue Origin, they have something called the Javis program, which somewhere down the road they plan on being able to recoup the second stage. But in fact, that was their original plan. They dropped Javis because they knew the physics behind it, you know, a real long time. Like, under development Blue Origin came around a little after year 2000 or something. So, yeah, okay. Anything else? Brian, back to you.
Oh, I understand now what you're saying with the speed differential. That's interesting. Is there any way for the Artemis capsule to put itself into a Earth orbit when it comes back? In other words, go ahead and fire some retros and slow it down so it goes into an Earth orbit and then could go around like one or two times and then come down into the atmosphere with a lower heat coefficient. Is that possible?
Not with what they have today. I mean, you know, you'd have to design it where the returning vehicle would have to have an engine on it as big as the one put it into translunar injection, or close to that speed, similar to the upper stage of the... the SLS system. You know, you have the first stage on SLS that you know, again gets it up to after about 8 minutes separates. Second stage continues on. So the engine that pushes the vehicle, you know, to the point where you get the translunar injection, TLI, to go from 17,500 miles an hour in orbit, and then eventually it has to accelerate another, roughly 7,000 miles per hour to go up to the moon. That means you'd have to slow the vehicle down coming back from the moon. If you're coming back at, you know, 25,000 miles an hour, you have to slow that energy down. Again, by 7,000 miles, you'd have to get from 25,000 miles an hour down to 18,000 or 17,500. That would be slowing that mass down. That means you would be the equivalent of another rocket engine as big as the second stage that got you there in the first place. So, yeah, you know, we don't have that technology. The initial rocket that would put you up there, instead of 8.8 million pounds of thrust, maybe we'd have to have, you know, 20,000 pounds of thrust. Who knows? Maybe with the Starship, you know, they might be able to develop something like the Starship is actually going to eventually have a push to, you know, to space instead of what SLS has at 8.8 million pounds. Starship is claiming they want to get up to, I think, double that number, maybe more. So you really can't do that. Again, the physics say no at this time, but, you know, physics also say, yeah, it is possible, but you just need a gigantic rocket to couple of big rocks to make all that happen. Back to you, Brian.
I get it. It's a mixture of inertia and fuel expenditure. So, yeah, no, that makes kind of sense. Well, maybe they should consider doing what the Russians do and try to land on land. I don't know how precisely they could go ahead and make the landing. how close they can get it to, say, land in, another state that's not that populated in a certain area. I don't know how granular they can get with that. So I guess the ocean, because it's so empty for the most part, is a safer bet. But and Russia is such a bigger country that they have so much room. It's chances of somebody getting hurt are very, very remote. All right. Well, thank you very much, Paul. Appreciate it. And nice speaking with you.
Again, you're actually right on the money again, Brian. You know, we have done that, of course, with the shuttle, you know, 135 times. But with the Starliner built by Boeing, that's the one that sent the crew of two up to the International Space Station.
That time was complete.
They got stuck there for 8 months instead of 8 days, you know. And that was the plan. They were up there for 8 months. But when that thing came back without a crew, because they were nervous about the reaction control jets, has gigantic airbags underneath the heat shield. So it's designed to, you know, to bring a crew of four up to the space station and back down. By the way, it was actually designed to bring up to seven people if they wanted to. But the plan was to, and still is, to eventually be able to send a crew up on Starliner with four people and return with four people and land on land, which they've done successfully. Boeing Starliner has sent three of these vehicles to orbit. One of them did not get to the space station. Fell short of being able to do that. And that came back and landed on land. The next one that went up was an uncrewed version that successfully docked with the International Space Station. They put up cargo and everything. But that was the first test. It was capable of bringing the crew up, but that was the first actual test to see if it would work. And they got to the space station with it. I remember the crew on board the space station went inside and, you know, poked around on the inside of it. And eventually it was sent back and, again, landed on Earth. And then the last one that went up, which took Sonny Williams and put Wilmore up to space station, and they got stuck for 8 months. That went back, deorbited, and eventually came back and landed on land. Where they landed was, you know, pinpoint accuracy, like you were saying. I mean, it landed exactly where it's supposed to, in White Sands, New Mexico. White Sands, New Mexico, a big open area. That's the primary landing location for Starliner. And in the future, give it up on this program, by the way. You don't read about that anymore, but if you research it, it's not a dead program. They're still working on it. They have a plan, maybe even getting another one off the ground by the end of this year. And again, this one will go up without a crew. They want to make sure the reaction control jets work fine and everything else on board Starliner works fine. It will dock with the International Space Station, and it will come back flying through the atmosphere again and land back in White Sands, New Mexico. If that works out, then we'll get, see another crew. And my guess is they'll probably send, at that point, maybe a crew of four up. See, that was the original plan. You know, SpaceX has many, have been sending crews to the space station. They send up four, they bring back four. They send up four, and they've been doing it roughly every 6 months. Once Starliner comes online officially, which of course it should have now, but with all the delays that Boeing has had, they're unable to get that cadence going. But that would be it, you know. Starliner then would go up with four, come back down with four eventually, every 6 months. And then, you know, that would be SpaceX's turn with Dragon. And this way, instead of SpaceX doing this ridiculous dance of sending crews up, you know, twice a year. They'll be doing it once a year, and so will Starliner. So hopefully by that time, and they get this regular cadence going, it'll seem normal for a couple of years, and the next thing you know, okay.